And we'll proceed with the next case, likewise represented by the student. This will be United States versus Jason White. Suhoy.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Suhoy. I'm a third-year law student, senior law student at the University of Chicago, arguing pursuant to Illinois Supreme Court Rule 711. I am counsel for the appellant defendant Jason White in this case. I would first like to argue the Batson issue. Jason White did not get a fair trial. This black defendant was tried and convicted by an all-white jury after the only African-American juror drawn into the panel, Juror Hayes, was struck by the government on account of her race. This violates the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution under Batson v. Kentucky.
Isn't it significant, though, that juror number 12, when asked if she had any preconceptions or attitudes that would affect her ability to be to serve as a juror, didn't simply respond no, but made a statement indicating she might have a problem of perception?
Your Honor, that may be important here, but this is not the case. The government's reason for its strike, as indicated in the record, was that Juror Hayes, the only African-American juror drawn to the panel, may not apply the beyond the reasonable doubt standard and may apply an absolute beyond doubt standard. Now, the statements that Juror Hayes made, that she was conservative, intended not to see things in great perceptions, was their evidence for the reason. The actual reason was that Juror Hayes may not apply the beyond the reasonable doubt standard and would apply an absolute beyond doubt standard. But those statements don't get you anywhere near to an absolute beyond doubt standard and not applying the beyond the reasonable doubt standard. In fact, it's counterintuitive. Juror Hayes' statements, when Juror Hayes made those statements in response to the jury questionnaire question, screams that she's pro-law enforcement, that she's an automatic conviction in a case with a suburban, alleged suburban crack dealer. In other words, Juror Hayes is a juror that the government should want on its panel. Instead, it offers this reason, this counterintuitive reason, this opposite reason, that Juror Hayes would have a bias against the government, that it would require a higher standard. Second of all, not only is it an implausible and illogical reason, counterintuitive, it's also refuted in the record. The only direct connection between Juror Hayes and the beyond the reasonable doubt standard indicates that she would apply it and understood it. During voir dire, Judge Springman, the trial court judge, compared the beyond the reasonable doubt standard to the preponderance standard, indicated that the beyond the reasonable doubt standard was the correct standard here, and asked the jurors if they would have any problem applying it. Juror Hayes indicated she would not. Furthermore, the record also indicates that Juror Hayes...
Well, she indicated she would not by her silence. Is that
yes,
right?
Your Honor.
I mean, she didn't answer affirmatively.
Yes, Your Honor. She indicated...
By her silence.
The judge posed the question, and the only way to answer would be in a way that the indication would be silence. Furthermore, the record indicates that Juror Hayes also served in a prior criminal case, showing that she had exposure with the beyond the reasonable doubt standard. And yet again, the government struck her for a completely opposite reason, that she wouldn't apply the beyond the reasonable doubt standard, that she would apply a higher standard. And again, the evidence the government points to for its reason was completely implausible. If the government was concerned about Juror Hayes' beyond the reasonable doubt standard or concerned about that question, the government could have asked a follow-up question. Judge Springman allowed follow-up questions. However, the government did not. Instead, it just jumped straight to striking the juror on a peremptory strike.
But doesn't her answer raise alarms as to her ability to weigh evidence and apply the burden of proof as instructed? I mean, wouldn't an answer like that raise alarm bells?
Your Honor, it may raise alarm bells, but even if it raised alarm bells, we have to hold the prosecutor, the government, to its stated reason. The government stated that its reason was that it would apply a beyond the reasonable that Juror Hayes would possibly require an absolute beyond doubt standard. And that statement just does not get you to Juror Hayes' statements in the jury questionnaire just do not get you to a bias against the government, an absolute beyond doubt standard. The connection, the leap from those statements to requiring a higher standard is just so implausible that this must be pretextual. Another reason that this strike was pretextual, Your Honors, is that it showed disparate treatment between the jurors. Again, the only only connection between Juror Hayes and the other jurors, between Juror Hayes and the beyond reasonable doubt standard showed that she would apply it and understood it. She answered the question like all the other jurors drawn into the panel, all the other white jurors. And yet they were not struck for that reason. They were deemed fit for service. This is exactly what Batson is supposed to stop. As this court stated in Splunge v. Clark or Coulter v. Gilmore, this disparate treatment between jurors is a violation of the Constitution.
Well, was there a juror that responded to the question in any way close to how she responded? Perhaps I missed that in the record.
The record does not indicate that there was another juror who indicated it, who answered question 16B in that way, Your Honor.
Right. Was there anything in the record of any other response to 16B other than a no by the other jurors? So when you're making your argument that she was singled out or treated differently, I'm trying to understand what you're hanging your hat on. As I said, maybe I missed the evidence.
Your Honor, we don't know if other jurors answered question 16A or B. If they answered it at all, we just know that Juror Hayes was the only question, the only juror who answered that question in that way, according to the record.
Right. So that's why I'm trying to get a handle on, you know, your comparison of her with the other jurors and their response to that specific question, or really their response to any other questions that, you know, perhaps the government didn't choose to strike them but chose her. Do you have anything else?
The record does not indicate any other.
All right. Thank you.
Differentiations between the jurors' questions.
Now, it's going to the other issue. Is there anything in the record other than the sign in the window stating barbershop that would cause Detective Henry to believe it was a multi-unit building? And as a
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Isn't it common to provide haircutting services out of people's homes?
Your Honor, it may be common to provide barbershop to haircutting services in people's homes. However, this doesn't take away from the multi-unit nature of this building. The problem here is that the search warrant did not particularly describe the place to be searched. It called it a single-family residence, when in fact it was a multi-unit building. It had two apartments, a barbershop, and a garage, a detail shop out back. Probable cause, the search warrant affidavit only established probable cause for a vague area inside this premises. It didn't specify the exact unit to be searched.
As I understand it, he went to the door and the undercover, confidential informant, whatever he was, went to 118 and talked about at the door, at the entry, of purchasing the drug. Now, it is true that what we know now is that this was sort of divided up, but it was also a brother living upstairs in the other apartment, so to speak, who ultimately claims the drugs were his, and a mother who, I guess, runs the rest of it, and I guess the brother also runs the barbershop. You say in your reply brief, for example, that Mr. White simply objected to the search warrant on different grounds than he does now. Had he objected on these grounds, wouldn't the prosecution also have an opportunity to say, oh yeah, but this is all one big happy family, and yeah, you can go to the door and ask for drugs and nobody says anything, and then you have to go get them someplace else? Couldn't they have then made the case, had it been presented, that this is a legitimate global, if you will, search?
Possibly, Your Honor. That may have supplemented the record, but we can still show, even on a plain error standard, even if it wasn't raised below, that this was a constitutional error. First, again, as I stated, the search warrant failed to particularize the place to be searched, and that was constitutional error. Second, the error was plain because it was a constitutional error. If constitutional errors, as this court has stated in Shue, are more freely recognized, it certainly affects the defendant, Jason White's substantial rights, and the outcome of the proceeding. and it affects the fairness and integrity of this court because the court fails in its role to control the conduct of law enforcement officers to protect privacy interests. There's no more questions, John.
Okay, I'll give you a little extra time for rebuttal. We had a lot of questions. Mr. Miller?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Miller. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I'm the individual that tried this case. With regard to the Batson issue raised by counsel, in this particular case, that is the fact that there was only one African-American on the jury. I had peremptory challenges, I believe six. The question with regard, the answer that the juror number 12 gave, that she tended not to see things in great perceptions, I had no idea what she's talking about. I just had no idea what she's talking about.
Yeah, that was my question to you. What does that mean?
I have no idea what it meant, but it disturbed me to the extent that when she's talking about perceptions, I don't know the depth or what the definition is or anything like
that. Well, how do you tie that?
I'm sorry.
Sorry, how do you tie that then to her not saying that to the proof beyond a reasonable doubt? If you have no idea what it means, how do you link it to that?
It was my understanding that the government had to have a non-racial reason. I could have said I have no idea what she's talking about, but when she's talking about perceptions, then I don't know if she can't perceive what reasonable doubt is. I don't, because there's no jury instruction on reasonable doubt. I don't know if she has a problem with regard to evidence that's being presented, that maybe there should be more. I don't know if she had issues with regard to the technical laboratory evidence that it's crack cocaine. I had no idea what it was. So my reasoning was, if I don't know what she's talking about by perception, it may, and I believe that's what I said, affect her ability to apply the proper standards here.
But weren't you happy when you heard she was conservative?
Not necessarily. I mean, contrary to what people may think, I think the government would like to have a fair trial with fair people there also. And the mere fact that someone's conservative doesn't necessarily mean that they're friendly to the government, nor would I want someone that was friendly to the government. I would want someone that was fair and would be open in terms of hearing the evidence that's presented.
I bet you're the only prosecutor in America who doesn't want somebody that's friendly to the government.
That may be. I've been doing this a while, but that's my philosophy regarding
all right.
I must admit, with regard to the time I did this appeal, my focus was not as it should have been with regard to the issue of forfeiture and waiver. My problem was, and I struggled with this and apparently did not broaden my focus until probably 2 days ago, and that is I couldn't find anything in the record, and my understanding is, what error did the court commit that you're going to look to say they did something wrong? I couldn't find anything here because the issue was a state court judge had issued a search warrant. My perception was of the law, I'm bound by the corners of that document, which we were. And in that document, it was sufficient to establish probable cause. Counsel has argued or stated in the brief indications regarding the nature of the property, that is, that it was a multi-purpose or multi-occupied unit. However, at the time that these acts occurred, it was after hours, the barbershop wasn't open, the confidential informant knocked on the door. I think that the record is the confidential informant was there about 12 minutes, came back with the dope. There's no evidence in the debriefing by the police officers that the informant went anywhere else in the house or that there was anyone else in the house. And in fact, as Judge Mannion pointed out, one of the brothers at trial got up and said, well, I live upstairs. And that was my dope. I found it when I was sweeping up the barbershop, and I just put it back here in the drawer, and it was next to a gun that I had also bought on the street from someone. The jury obviously did not believe that. I don't believe that they believed he lived there, in fact. So at the time that the affidavit was prepared, the evidence and the information that the officers had was that it appeared to be a single family residence. There was a sign in the window saying that it was a barbershop. The other fact is that the only person that came to the door or was there that's in the record is the defendant, and he opened the door. He had dominion and control over the entire property. And given that record, they tried to get in under a Franks hearing the argument that there was deliberate falsehood on the part of the officers. They were not successful in that. They could not show that it was deliberate. So they lost on the Franks hearing. They still attempted to get the mother on the stand in that hearing also to put on evidence, but it would not tend to show or produce anything showing that the officers knew or should have known that it was a multi-purpose or other people were living there. So the court ruled, based on the probable cause affidavit, the affidavit showed probable cause. It was issued by a state court, and the search took place, and the drugs and gun were found in the premises where the confidential informant had purchased the drugs before. So my view was there's no error in the record. The judge did everything properly. There's nothing in the record indicating that there was any evidence that would go toward particularity. And in fact, for the purposes of this affidavit, the address and the house was in fact where they observed the person go in the house, and it was set out 118 West Creighton Street in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And in fact, that's what they got the search warrant for and came back and searched there.
In hindsight, knowing now that it's an operating barber shop as well as being two separate places to live, and I don't know, was there another place for the mother? I don't know.
The mother lived somewhere else.
Okay, so it was just that. Is there, just taking that in itself as being plain error, does that make it automatic in some way that this could not have been a drug house, so to speak, where, as you say, the defendant came to the door, the one entrance? Is there some way that this is obviously divisible that it should have been recognized when they did the search, the affidavit?
Not that I'm aware of. What I understood was the mother had prepared this property or structure for her children or her son to live there. And the only person that the police knew that was living there at the time was the defendant, Jason White, not his brother or anyone else. And in fact, I believe the record was that there was either mail, his billfold, his driver's license, etc., were the only items showing who occupied this property when they searched the property. So I would have to say that it is possible that a plain error analysis may apply rather than waiver. However, the waiver goes to the fact that they did not waive a Fourth Amendment argument. They raised the argument. And it's only speculation that it had other people living in it, that it was a multi-unit property. In other cases like this, the officers or the CI went inside, went upstairs, there was numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, came back out. Then they got a search warrant, not for the specific apartment, but for that building. In this case, that's not what happened. There is no evidence that there was a separate apartment that the informant went to and acquired the drugs. She went inside and got $50 worth of crack and came back and gave it to the police officers. And I think a couple days later they gave a search, went to the judge and gave a search warrant, a request for a search warrant. In hindsight, and I've discussed this with the local police, that they should be aware of this problem, that they should try to find out from the informant, is it a multi-occupied dwelling? Are there other apartments? Where did this informant go? But I think the record was the informant went to the door, went inside the door, and I don't think he went anywhere else, and waited and got the crack and came back out. I see my time is up, unless the court has other questions.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Suhoy? You've got about a minute. I'll give you a couple minutes if
Thank
you
God.
Had some questions here.
First, Your Honors, I'd like to say, to clear up my disparate treatment argument, the only question about the burden of proof asked to the jurors, Juror Hayes answered in the exact same way as the other jurors. So with respect to the beyond reasonable doubt, which is at issue here, the only question asked showed that she would apply the standard correctly. Second, the government has conceded during oral argument that he didn't know what that statement meant. That makes this claim even stronger. If the government did not know what that answer meant, why didn't he ask follow-up questions? It's in effect saying that he struck this juror because he just had a bad feeling about her. That is a paradigm case of pretext here. Again, if he was confused about the statement, worried in any way.
But the law doesn't prevent the government from striking someone if they have a bad feeling about the person, as long as it's not tied to race. I mean, they can have that visceral reaction to a juror and not articulate it. Indeed, some of the great trial lawyers of our time can't articulate why they want a juror on or off. But it's only if it's tied to race, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. It's only if it's tied to race. And that's another this case is about the Stage 3 Batson, about pretext. It's not about a race-neutral reason. The government's reasons may be race-neutral, but again, they show pretext because it was refuted in the record, because it was illogical and counterintuitive with what the government's own evidence presented here is. And it evidences disparate treatment between black and white jurors.
So you wouldn't be arguing at all if, indeed, the prosecutor had said, I am striking her because she makes no sense to me?
Your Honor, I think that's a different case than what we have here. The government has given a reason that, a very specific reason, that the juror would not apply the correct beyond the reasonable doubt standard. That's not like saying I have a bad feeling. It's not like saying I just don't, the juror doesn't make sense to me. It's giving a very specific reason, which is refuted in the record, which they give evidence for, which is completely counterintuitive, and it's evidence of disparate treatment between the black and white jurors. The ultimate question here is whether the government's reason should be believed. And when we have these three reasons, refuted in the record, illogical, counterintuitive, and disparate treatment, the only conclusion that can be drawn is that the government should not be believed. The reason was pretextual, and reversal is appropriate.
Your time's up. You got anything to say on the other issue?
No, I believe the issues were addressed correctly.
Okay, fine. Well, the case will be taken under advisement. And to you, too, Mr. Suhoy, thank you for your fine advocacy on behalf of your client. You did a fine job. And thank you, Professor Mikla, for both cases.
Thank you.
And this case will be taken under advisement.